From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The investigation into the financial dealings of an organization run by Florida's First Lady continues.
So now we're wondering, was money from a Medicaid settlement spent on politics?
Also this week, President Trump gives the nod to several Florida politicians, especially those who say positive things about him.
The American people spoke loud when they put President Trump back in the White House.
We'll also have a sit-down with a Republican candidate for Florida governor who hasn't gotten the Trump endorsement, at least not yet, and we'll meet some of the women who were a critical part of the P-Funk mothership. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Millions of dollars from a state Medicaid settlement ended up going to a charity effort spearheaded by First Lady Casey DeSantis. WUSF's Douglas Soule talked about it with Miami Herald reporter Alexandra Glorioso. She's been at the forefront of reporting on how that money ended up being investigated by a grand jury.
A grand jury met in Tallahassee to consider whether the Hope Florida Foundation's spending practices broke any laws. The foundation supports a state program connecting Floridians in need with nonprofit services. The Florida House, led by Republican Representative Alex Andrade, investigated. The DeSantises deny any wrongdoing. Alexandra, how closely connected are they to this charity?
Casey DeSantis' name is on the ceremonial checks that they give out to nonprofits, largely churches. And she actually wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, you know, touting the program as the conservative answer to welfare. So it was largely and widely speculated among political insiders that she would use this program to launch her gubernatorial campaign to replace her husband in office, who is term limited. It's now believed that it's less likely that Casey DeSantis will run for governor because of the whole saga.
There's a lot of backstory to this saga, but what was one of the pivotal moments?
I got a hold of these really interesting meeting minutes from last October, which showed that the foundation had gotten a $10 million cash infusion. That $10 million cash infusion was from a broader $67 million Medicaid settlement with a healthcare company called Centene. That introduced all kinds of issues about whether this transfer of money was legal. And eventually, it came out that this money went to two dark money groups, one connected to the Chamber of Commerce and one that is an organization called Save Our Society from Drugs. And they got two identical $5 million grants. And it appears that they then transferred most of that money, $8.5 million, to a political committee controlled by Governor Ron DeSantis' then chief of staff, James Uthmeyer, who he later appointed as attorney general when there was a vacancy. So now we're wondering, was money from a Medicaid settlement spent on politics? Because that political committee was created to defeat the recreational marijuana amendment on last year's ballot.
Do we know if, and not to speculate about a potential criminal case, do we know if the charges could go as high up as the First Lady herself?
It's unclear who could eventually be involved in any kind of indictment or whether the grand jury would even indict. You know, Representative Andrade did not make Casey DeSantis a focus of his probe. The people who he has accused of wrongdoing are James Uthmeyer, the attorney general, and Jeff Aaron, the attorney for the Hope Florida Foundation. And Jeff Aaron has represented the governor in many different other cases.
beyond the Hope Florida stuff. DeSantis also reportedly used tax dollars to squash the abortion access amendment and the marijuana amendment that appeared on the 2024 ballot. Both did not pass. Why was DeSantis so motivated to achieve that?
The governor has said that it was important to defeat these amendments because he has spent a lot of energy in creating a red state in Florida. These constitutional amendments would send mixed signals and potentially attract more liberal voters to the state, which would be a political problem.
Alexandra Glorioso is a reporter with the Miami Herald. She says the grand jury could have word as early as next month. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Well, President Donald Trump has sure been weighing in on Florida's statewide elections over the past couple weeks, and that could potentially have some pretty large implications for the 2026 election. So, since we're talking about those kinds of things, politics and government, why not bring in our politics and government reporter, Tristan Wood, to kind of break down these sorts of happenings. So, hey, Tristan.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, and I'm sure that anyone who President Trump endorsed this week might be doing well or not. So,
yeah, I would say it'd be doing particularly well.
Who did he come out in favor of as far as the statewide stuff is concerned?
So he decided to tap Florida Agriculture Commissioner Wilton Simpson for re-election. Now that move, you know, as we alluded to, has several large political implications. Simpson's name was in the rumor mill to run for governor against Trump's pick for that job, current Congressman Byron Donalds. Now this endorsement likely signals that Simpson will not be running for governor, putting a lot of those rumors to bed, but almost guaranteeing that he would be reelected in the Republican primary and then in the general election with Trump's name at his back and with incumbent advantage.
Okay, so with Ag Commissioner Simpson potentially out of the running there, who does that leave running for governor on the Republican side of the slate?
Well, there's currently two prominent candidates that have filed. Donalds, like I previously mentioned, but also former Florida House Speaker Paul Renner. There are several other names bouncing around, namely current Lieutenant Governor and ally of Governor Ron DeSantis, Jay Collins. However, polling for these races so far has Donalds ahead by a large margin. We're talking 28, 30 points. But an important thing to note there is that on those polls, a large number of Republican undecided voters generally don't know who any of these candidates are in the first place. So there's still a lot of time for them to try to run their campaigns, but Donalds is having Trump's endorsement definitely has kickstarted him and put him to the front of the race.
Yeah, I mean, those of us like yourself who follow this day in and day out, it seems like, boy, we've been talking about this forever, but for the average voter, we are not even within the event horizon of the election. That is really more than a year off, so it makes some sense to indicate that this isn't really getting a lot of public traction here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of these politicians are getting the word out to politicos that they're running, collecting their donations, going around meeting with different local parties around the state, doing that type of work. They're not really at the pound the televisions with ad stages or the go hold big rally stages. They're more at the talk to people in the political know, raise money, get endorsements and alliances stage.
Enjoy your TV while you can. Anyway, stepping away from the Gov's race, who else has President Trump endorsed here?
So earlier this month, he tapped State Attorney General James Uthmeyer. There were rumors that Team Trump were going to run another candidate due to Uthmeyer's closeness with Governor Ron DeSantis and kind of the at each other's heads that Trump and DeSantis have had historically. But Trump previously signaled that he looked at Uthmeyer favorably. The AG worked closely with the Trump admin on their immigration enforcement pushes in the state, including being the front man in Florida for opening Alligator Alcatraz, that controversial detention facility in the middle of the Everglades. At the opening of that, Trump also said that Uthmeyer called him handsome. So ever since that moment, kind of the question was, is Trump going to endorse Uthmeyer? Is he not? And we got our answer about a week and a half ago. Yes, he is.
All right. So Trump has weighed in on those races. Are there any that he has not given his yay or approval for?
Yes. Noticeably, he hasn't endorsed in the CFO race. current Florida CFO Blaise Ingolia, as recently as this week, has been giving high praise towards the president, like these comments he made at a press conference.
The American people spoke loud when they put President Trump back in the White House with a mandate, a clear and obvious mandate to fix the border and address the wide-ranging issues caused by illegal immigration. I am thankful for President Trump's commitment to protecting the American people.
Notably, Ingolia was previously the chair of the Republican Party of Florida and has longstanding relationships with some people in Trump's camp. So the fact that an endorsement hasn't come out yet has raised some question marks all among political watchers. Who else might run for that seat? One of the main voices coming up in those conversations is State Representative Kevin Steele. When I spoke with him, he wouldn't say with certainty whether he'll run or not, but he did express that he'd be open to running if he got endorsed by Trump.
If Trump wanted me to run for that position, I would jump on it in a heartbeat. I do want to have an impact on the state of Florida. I think there's a lot of things that we can do together to solve problems.
Thus spake Representative Kevin Steele, and thus also spake our politics and government reporter, Tristan Wood. Thanks for joining us on Capitol Report, Tristan.
It's no problem, Tom.
Coming up on Capitol Report, despite the Florida candidates President Trump is backing now, one gubernatorial hopeful thinks he'll wind up with all or most of the endorsement marbles.
In the end, the governor will get behind us and support us, and I'd welcome his support, as well as the president, at some point.
And the women who were so integral to George Clinton's mothership of funk are finally getting their due.
So I have to speak for her. I have to get these stories out there. And that her legacy would be cemented for all of the unbelievable things she did.
Former Florida House Speaker Paul Renner joins the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast this week to talk about his bid to be Florida's next governor. Renner explains why he's the best candidate to replace Governor Ron DeSantis next year, saying he's delivered on results for Floridians and has steady leadership experience. Here's an excerpt.
Byron Donalds has been endorsed by President Donald Trump. I know you're a Donald Trump fan. You can't be a leader in Florida, a Republican leader in Florida, without being one nowadays. So how do you get over that? Is there a hurdle for you fundraising, getting endorsements, getting support when you've got Donald Trump is such a rock star and he's thrown his support behind one of your opponents?
Well, there's endorsements and then there's endorsements. That's a big one. And so certainly it's something that has to be contended with, but I don't think that's the end of the story. And so I talk about three different things that every voter, really in any race, but especially for governor, think about. And that is, first of all, that this is not an entry-level position. So you're looking for someone, if you're hiring the CEO of the third largest state in America, 15th or 16th largest economy in the world, has leadership experience, because it is a big, big leadership role. In my case, 20 years in the military, served in two wars, was an assistant state attorney, so prosecuted violent criminals, stood up for victims, had leadership there as well, where my peers selected me to supervise misdemeanor attorneys, and then was a lead in the felony trial unit. Leadership throughout my life, and then, of course, as Speaker of the House, two super consequential years. And so the second thing people should look at is results. We're all going to say a lot of the same things on the Republican side as the Democrats would say on the Democrat side. The question is, who's actually delivered those results? And I think it's because we had that successful 2 years in part because of my military background, which is I put the mission over ego and pettiness and politics, and it's rampant. It's rampant in the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. We all have to check our ego at the door. And I think with a great partner in Kathleen Passidomo, who did the same thing, who just wanted what was good for Florida. And we differed. She's more moderate. I'm more conservative, like the governor, philosophically. But we work very, very well together. And another lesson from the military is criticize in private, praise in public. Mm. Very simple to say. It's harder to do sometimes when people frustrate you. But we did that. And we had disagreements. She and I did. Governor and I did. She and the governor did. But we figured it out. We got a landing spot, came out united. We got a huge, huge amount of things done in those 260-day sessions. And I don't think anybody would contest that those were very, very consequential years. And then the final thing is somewhat related to the first two is who do you trust? Or if to rephrase it, who do you trust the most in the race? And trust comes a little bit from those first two things. Who's got the steady leadership experience that we can look at? And with the governor, we saw him go through COVID. We've seen him go through hurricanes. You establish and you earn trust in life, right? Wherever that is, in a relationship, but with the voters, you earn trust. And you earn it, I believe, by having a strong background, by accomplishing things and solving problems. And then people can look at, you know, what I've done in my life and how I've conducted myself and where I've focused really on not, you know, self-advancement or climbing the political ladder as much as really getting things done. And I'm very proud and want to make sure I give a shout out to every House member and senator who was involved in everything I got accomplished as speaker. There was somebody sponsoring that bill, somebody working to get that done.
Well, I love when my guests do this, and you did it, I think, four times in what you just said, and that is that you hit on four of the questions that I was going to ask. Now, I don't know how deep we're going to get into this, because one of the things that you also said was criticize in private and praise in public. So I am going to ask you some tough questions, sure, and we'll see how you answer. You worked very closely with the governor to, it was your agenda and the governor's agenda. You were much more closely aligned, I think, ideologically than with President Pasadomo. And yet he kind of dissed you when you came out and announced you were running. Was that a surprise to you?
Well, having just announced one of my principles of good leadership.
I set it up all wrong.
I have said, and will say again on your show, that I am confident that in the end, the governor will get behind us and support us. And I'd welcome his support as well as the president at some point, whenever that is. And so he's done a great job as governor. I think that, however, objectively, I think that if you're looking as many Republicans are, as we don't want to go backwards. Who can step in objectively and continue the legacy that the governor's begun? Well, you'd look at someone who has helped build that legacy, and you'd have to put me on that list.
Right.
And also is going to be a good partner for the president in the years to come after this governor's gone and the new governor is in office to help the president with his agenda. You know, and I think there's going to be overlap with both the governor and the president on 95% of things. I will say this, and it's one of our monikers is putting Florida first. And so where there's differences, and you saw this with the governor and the president, you've seen it a couple different times, there is, I love what the president's doing. I love what the governor's done and is doing. But if I disagree, if I think the interests of Florida lie elsewhere, I'm not afraid to speak up and say that. And I think that's what people want. People want a true leader who's got policy depth, who's looked at hard issues, who's worked with people, including across the aisle. I'm very conservative, but I did a lot of things while I was speaker that were priorities, or you would look at as priorities of people across the aisle, because they were good ideas. And we had bipartisan support for those ideas. And so I want to get things done. I want to solve problems. I've proven I can do that. And I think objectively, if you're looking at who to continue the DeSantis era, so we protect and expand what we have and still solve the challenges of tomorrow, you turn to somebody who solved yesterday's challenge.
That was former House Speaker Paul Renner on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Property insurance reforms are working and bringing down rates, according to Florida's next Senate president. Republican State Senator Jim Boyd, who will take over leadership of the upper legislative chamber following the 2026 elections, says insurance changes he sponsored over the past few years are starting to work. More private insurance companies are entering Florida, while the state-run Citizens Property Insurance has seen a decrease in policies in recent months. State regulators have approved a series of requests by private insurers to assume policies from Citizens Property Insurance as the hurricane season winds down. Boyd says increasing competition among private insurers will be good for Floridians.
We paid a lot for our homeowners insurance. Those rates are going down. I believe we're going to see even more downward movement on those rates, and I'm excited about that because that's the reform that we tried to put into place that would accomplish that.
Citizens was created as an insurer of last resort, but grew in recent years to become the state's largest insurer amid problems in the private market. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Parliament Funkadelic was founded by Tallahassee resident George Clinton in 1968. P-Funk was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nearly three decades ago, but none of the group's women were invited, as WLRN's Natu Twe reports.
Hustle on over here.
Parliament Funkadelic is perhaps the greatest funk band ever, often described as a wild, brilliant, and world-changing musical collective. But when the group was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1997, none of the women who helped create the sound and performed in P-Funk were invited to the ceremony, and their contributions have been largely overlooked. A new book, Mothership Connected, sets the record straight. It tells the story of women like Malia Franklin, Lynn Marbury, Dawn Silva, Debbie Wright, and Shirley Hayden, all of whom were instrumental in making Parliament Funkadelic, as well as the spin-off groups Parliament and the Brides of Funkenstein, into the legends they are today. The author of Mothership Connected is Seth Neblin, who's the son of the queen of funk, Malia Franklin. The book weaves together the voices of funk legends like George Clinton, Sly Stone, Bootsy Collins, along with the women who were instrumental to P-Funk's success. Mothership Connected, Seth says, was not supposed to be a book. It was originally supposed to be a documentary. He met director Paul Justman in 2003. Justman at the time made an award-winning documentary called Standing in the Shadows of Motown about the Funk Brothers and Motown Records. Paul grew increasingly interested in Seth's pitch and talked to some of the women and wanted to film the documentary. However, after a year of work, no one was biting on the idea.
Paul said to me, Seth, I think you're going to need a book to try to get this documentary done. So we started talking to different authors, and that was 2004. You know, one night I was having dinner with Bootsy, me and my mother, and I was, you know, griping about the fact that we're trying to get this book done and we can't find the right writer and this has just been a pain in the butt, da 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 da. And Bootsy just said, well, you've already started doing the work. You just do it, finish it. That took me aback because I was never a person that fancied themselves as a writer or right. I'm going to write this book. But I had so much invested in it by now. I had to finish it, you know? And then when my mother passed away in 2010 at 57, that gave me a whole new meaning to have to finish it because mm-hmm. she's no longer here to speak for herself. So I have to speak for her. I have to get these stories out there. And that her legacy would be cemented for all of the unbelievable things she did for Parliament Funkadelic and in the music industry. But it was also just as important for me to shine light on the other women that were main participants of this book. Lynn Mabry and Dawn Silva, who were the original Brides of Funkenstein, and Debbie Wright, who was an original parlette with my mother, who was also a parlette, and Shirley Hayden, who was the woman that came in and replaced Debbie Wright not long after the group was released. And so it was very important, you know, because for me, even as a child, there's a certain sacrifice that you give when you have a parent that is in show business. Mine isn't different from many other children of entertainers and singers and stuff like that. But if nobody ever heard the story or nobody ever got to hear all the great things that my mother did, then it made me feel like, you know, that sacrifice could have been seen as a waste. So I had to make sure that their stories, her story, was chronicled for music history.
Did your view of any of your multiple aunts and uncles change after getting all these full stories?
I don't think that it changed who I felt they were. It just explained some things.
Right.
It just explained some things I could understand a little bit differently. Perfect example was like Lynn Mabry's relationship with Juni Morrison.
Juni Morrison was brought to P-Funk by Neblett's mother. He became the group's musical director and keyboardist for them and the Brides of Funkenstein. His musical genius greatly contributed to Parliament's most commercially successful album, One Nation Under a Groove. However, his relationship with Lynn Mabry was tumultuous.
And the way that I had always heard it, through other people talking about it. It was different once I heard her talk about it, because there were things that she talked about that other people weren't privy to. And having her talk about it, I'm not going to say it made it make sense, but I'm going to say that I understood her more. Same with Dawn Silva. You know, I understood her better learning about her childhood. And one thing that was important for me for these main five women is to really get into their childhoods and the things that happened before Parliament Funkadelic, because those traumas and all those things shaped that woman when she walks in the door.
Yeah, they carried it.
Right. So Lynn is searching for love. So she gets in these relationships that are really not the greatest for her. You know, Dawn has had issues with her father being abusive. So she tends to get with men that are abusive. My mother, always having to fight, always feeling like she had to prove herself.
Right.
You know, prove that she was Black enough. So for me, it was important that you understood who these women were.
When you talked to them, was there any sense of regret?
I think that their biggest regret, at least that I picked up, is that they didn't recognize their own power at the time. And because they didn't know or they didn't realize how much power they had, that caused probably more regret than anything else. I remember there was one quote that my mother said right after Lynn left the Brides, and she had already left Parlette. And they were both involved in relationships. You know, my mother was with Donnie Sterling at the time, who was a producer and Parlette's bass player, and Lynn was with Juni. And my mother said, if me and Lynn had have realized what kind of power we had because of the positions we held in the group, maybe we could have made something change. Now, that might be wishful thinking. You know what I mean? But they didn't even know how to express that. Because I just think they just didn't feel that they had any power. And anytime they did try to assert some kind of power, you know, it was kind of beat down.
Right.
So, you know, it was like some of it was just compliance. This is just what it is. And it gives me enough of whatever it gives me, even if it's hopes and dreams. Because some of them, that's all they've got from that experience. And that's sad.
Yeah.
But hopefully this book will rectify some of it.
I'm Natu Twe.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Douglas Saul, Derek Hamm, and Natu Twe. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week, online and on air, for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.